From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those Friday the 13th open lines. Want to welcome some new affiliates to Coast family. KUBC AM in Montrose, Colorado, the voice of the valley. Welcome aboard. KWSX AM in Modesto, California. WINH FM in Terre Haute, Indiana. WTJS AM in Jackson, Tennessee. And as I mentioned a few days ago, KNSS AM in Wichita, Kansas. They join us this coming Sunday. Congress has just passed the final version of the $787 billion economic stimulus plan aimed at jolting the slumping U.S. economy, they hope, sending the legislation now to President Obama's desk for his signature. The plan combines $281 billion in tax cuts with $308 billion in outlays funded by the appropriations committees, and then about $198 billion in spending for benefit programs such as unemployment assistance, $250 payments for millions of people receiving Social Security benefits, and extra money for states to help with the Medicaid health program for the poor and disabled. And the biggest players in the mortgage industry are halting home foreclosures while the Obama administration develops its plan to help struggling homeowners. The White House said President Barack Obama on Wednesday will outline his much-anticipated plan to spend at least $50 billion to prevent foreclosures. Now, more than 2.3 million homeowners faced foreclosure proceedings last year, an 81% increase from 2007. And analysts say that number could soar as high as 10 million in the coming years, depending on the recession or depression. Government-controlled mortgage finance companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and major banks J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, they are halting foreclosures through March 6. Wells Fargo, as well as Citigroup, will also halt or extend until the administration has completed details of the loan modification program, which will occur sometime around March 13th or so. Catherine Austin Fitz with us, managing director of the board of directors of the Wall Street investment banking firm. She did that once. Now she heads up Solari.com. She's on the line with us. Catherine, what do you think now? Now that they've all signed off on this and now goes to the president, what do you think?
Well, this plan is going to do a lot to stave off the breakdown we've been seeing in state and local government payments. I mean, it's not clear from the presentation in the press right now, but this is a major cash flow support to the states. The challenge, George, is there's no long-term vision that will really generate income for middle-income Americans, and so it wouldn't surprise me if this summer or by the end of the year, we're all back to where we started before, which is how do we get the fundamental productivity in the economy up and how do we get people building equity again?
I agree with you. What do you think his foreclosure plan is going to be?
I don't know. I used to have a deputy when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing that would say that the FHA fund or the government housing fund was where mortgages went to die. And my guess is what you're going to see is a big put from the private sector into some form of government fund or simply the government writing a check to just stave off. Now, it's interesting if you look at some estimates of the bailout, the bank bailout, It's the equivalent of having paid for almost all the mortgages in the country.
Oh,
so,
my.
If we had just not put money down a black hole, but basically for that amount of money, we could have retired all the mortgages in the country.
It all went down Mel's hole, an old guest on Coast to Coast. Catherine, thanks so much. We'll see you in Vancouver in a few weeks, okay?
Great.
Catherine Austin Fitz, I'll be in Vancouver. We've got a major event with our affiliate there, Vancouver, Canada, 1410, our big talk station there. And Catherine will be there, as will Whitley Strieber. And I'll tell you about that sometime next week. The peanut processing company at the heart of a national salmonella outbreak has filed for bankruptcy. The Virginia-based Peanut Corporation of America filed for Chapter 7. The company said in its filings that its debt and assets both range between $1 million and $10 million. The salmonella outbreak was traced to one of the company's plants in Georgia, where inspectors found roaches, mold, and a leaking roof. Federal investigators said the doomed Continental Flight 3407 experienced heavy ice buildup and lurched violently moments before it dove into a house near Buffalo, killing 50 people. Data collected from the plane's two black boxes shows a series of severe pitch and roll excursions shortly before the recording ended and the commuter jet crashed. Minutes earlier, the pilots reported significant ice buildup on the windshield and leading edge of the wings. They had already activated the de-icing mechanism on the aircraft just prior to the comments about the ice. I think they will find when they do the rest of their investigation that weather played the big, big reason for this crash. Among the passengers killed was Beverly Eckert, a woman whose husband died in the World Trade Center attacks of 9/11/2001. NASA mission managers have delayed the planned launch of the Space Shuttle Discovery for the third time now, with liftoff slated for no earlier than Feb 27. Pending the completion of ongoing fuel valve tests. The new delay will give engineers more time to complete a series of impact tests on shuttle fuel control valves at several NASA centers across the country. Richard C. Hoagland, head of the EnterpriseMission.com and our science advisor. Better safe than sorry, I guess, Richard, huh?
Well, again, George, you cannot believe the mainstream story.
What do we have then?
This is part of what happened two nights ago when a U.S. satellite and a Russian satellite collided.
Yes.
And created a huge shrapnel cloud of debris that is now estimated by some experts to last in orbit for 10,000 years.
Are you saying the shuttle delay may be based on that collision?
That's exactly what my source is tonight. Remember, I sent you an email earlier. I was expecting a call. I got the call. This is a cover story. They've had this poppet valve problem for several weeks now, but it's damn convenient because the last thing NASA wants to do is to publicly admit that this shrapnel is going to cause a problem for the shuttle because it will also then cause a problem for the space station. Space station is a huge target. It's the size of a football field. The current mission, the Discovery 119 mission, which was supposed to leave on the 22nd, has now been pushed back to the 27th. Is taking up the last of the big solar panels, which, if they are erected, will create this huge target for all this tiny shrapnel created by the collision of those 2,000-plus-pound birds two nights ago.
Now, if this indeed is the reason for the delay, Richard, what are they doing? How are they going to get around this?
Well, what they're going to have to do is to assess, because at the moment they're in the process of observing how this cloud expands. There is some online graphics showing some of the experts' belief in terms of celestial mechanics of how this debris is spreading out around the Earth and affecting other nearby satellite orbits.
Yeah.
The shuttle orbits at about 230 miles. The cloud is currently located around 500 miles, but the collision knocked lots of these pieces into long elliptical orbits that dip down below the orbit of the shuttle and the space station. And all it takes, George, is one, because the collisional velocity from, again, my sources who actually were involved in the activities that night, this was something like 15,000 miles per hour.
Jeez. Now, Richard, what's new at the EnterpriseMission.com?
Well, against this, there is a backdrop of Obama. There is a war going on upstairs, George. Let me hit it right on the head. And we need a longer period on the show for me to lay out the pieces that are coming in. But remember, I said two nights ago this was not an accident. Now it's been confirmed, and NASA is withholding, shuttle launch permission so they can evaluate the risk. You're going to see a cascade of satellite failures because of this debris cloud, including the Iridium network itself. There is strong evidence. Remember, that when this happened two days ago, the Russians blamed NASA for not doing the proper calculations and keeping the Iridium satellite from hitting the Russian one, right?
That's true.
There's only one problem with that. NASA's not the agency responsible. It's the U.S. Air Force out of Space Systems Command, located at both NORAD and Colorado Springs, and at a little place called S4. Well, my intel sources are now providing me a steady stream of very interesting correlating information. This is so much bigger than we have been allowed to believe. In fact, George, it feeds into not only what you just discussed with Catherine Austin Fitz, but conversations you've been having over the last several days relating to the larger plan. What's with all this money? This network, this communications network of Iridium satellites, turns out it is the backbone of the electronic funds transfers for the money that's been disappearing in Wall Street.
Interesting. Hey, I've got some NASA supporters who want a piece of you. You up for a debate?
Absolutely.
All right, Richard. Thanks again. Richard C. Hoagland, head of the EnterpriseMission.com. People with a sprained ankle now recover faster if they are given a plaster cast, according to British researchers. A study of 600 patients found that a 10-day below-knee cast is more effective than standard treatment with a tubular bandage. The findings published in The Lancet are at odds with general medical opinions that the best thing for a sprained ankle is simply to keep moving. If you go up to coasttocoastam.com and look under Hot Stories, you're going to click one that says Record Fingernails Broken. A woman with the world's largest fingernails has lost them in a car accident. And you can see that picture of those fingernails. Lee Redman, 67 years old of Salt Lake City, Utah, had been growing her fingernails since 1979. They were the longest in the world, according to the Guinness World Records. They were last measured, these are fingernails now, 33 inches long. Again, we've got a picture of it under Hot Stories at coasttocoastam.com. They're broken off in a four-car pileup. Her injuries are not life-threatening. And this email in from Wally says, George, I just want to let you know, my friend has a family in Rolleto, Arizona, which is a very small town completely surrounded by Marana, Arizona, near Tucson, and has informed me that people in Rolleto, a little population of less than 100, have witnessed a creature there that flew from the air and consumed all the blood in two dogs in someone's yard. A woman by the name of Josie, who lives there, was walking outside at night and spotted a creature that looked like a kangaroo but had wings that flew very quickly by them. Landed in the yard, ate two dogs right in front of them. We're going to check into that story. Wally, thanks for sending that to us. And off the coast of Southern California, there is Catalina Island, appearing to be an energy portal to another world. Strange and unexplainable things occur there, and whoever or whatever lurks in the shadows can be heard, felt, sometimes seen. For those who have witnessed the events, it's all too real. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. I was at a conference a few months ago on the West Coast, and one of our listeners came up to me and handed me a book and said, George, you've got to read this. It was a small book, and it was called Hunted Catalina. Rob Lodarski has administered more than 1,500 archaeological and historical projects for federal, state, county, and city agencies, as well as private companies. And Rob's wife, Ann, is the president and founder of Heart World Arts Center for Children. Together now, they help us step into the energy portal or door to another world known as the ghostly and haunted Catalina Island. And here they are on Coast to Coast, Rob and Ann. Hello, you two. How are you?
Hey, George. Hi, we're doing great.
We're fine.
Let me tell you, I am so glad I went to this conference and they handed me this book that you two have put together. And it's fascinating. I did not know, you know, I've been living out in the L.A. area now for 6 years. I did not know that area has so many haunted stories.
I think the whole island, in fact, is probably haunted. It's one of those things that you talk to people about Catalina Island and they go, what? They live in Los Angeles and there are a lot of people who have never visited the island.
Yeah, that's amazing to me. A lot of people have never even been over there, much less know anything about the haunted history.
How did you two realize that this island is haunted? What kind of stories came your way before you decided to even publish and write the book?
Well, I'll begin because my background in archaeology, one of my first field classes through UCLA was on Catalina Island back in 1973. That takes me way back. But while I was there, and we camped out on the far side of the island for 3 months in a tent. We had a cook, and during that time, we're excavating a site called the Little Harbor Site, which is a very a very famous site for archaeologists, and people started telling me ghost stories. So I began just collecting them, and it was, you know, it took us almost 20 years after that to do the book, but I had gathered so many stories that by the time we finished our first book, Haunted Queen Mary, we decided, well, let's try Catalina Island since we go there all the time. And we had most of the stories by then, and it just flowed.
There's a zillion stories of things going on out there.
There's a lot more than what we've got. We'd like to get some more, too.
Well, exactly. And what we're doing right now is it's auspicious because we're just completing Haunted Catalina 2. So many stories came in over the last few years that the book has now doubled in size.
I've not taken the boat trip to Catalina Island, but I'm told that it takes about, 45 minutes or so?
It does,
yeah. An hour.
I don't take it either.
We take the helicopter.
we take the helicopter because water's not one of my favorite.
I'd love it on a nice summer day.
Oh, he gets seasick.
I get seasick, okay. Tell the truth.
Oh, and I guess the boats that go from California to Catalina Island, probably pretty small, I guess, then, right?
They have, one from San Diego, a hovercraft-type boat, one from Newport Beach, and then...
they're all pretty good size, They're not bad. It's just that they take, an hour, and the helicopter takes 15 minutes.
Well, why don't you two just go through the portal that apparently could be there?
Good point.
We haven't quite gotten that down yet. Yeah, we're working on it.
We're working on that part of it, but the helicopter is the next best thing to getting there really quickly. So. And I still do a lot of the archaeological work for the island company and the conservancy, so... I'm literally over there probably once every few months.
Tell me about some of the haunted areas out there.
Oh, God.
Pick out some of your favorites.
Well, for me, Avalon is just a magnificently haunted area in the sense that it's built, the main portion of Avalon is built on an archaeological site. It was one of the largest villages on the island. I think it was called Bay of the Moon. That is most of the restaurants and hotels fronting Crescent Street in the main part of Catalina, almost all of them are haunted. They all have stories.
And the casino. Very, very active.
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
We just did about a month or 2 months ago, we did a KISS FM live broadcast. Every year they go someplace different for Halloween. So we did a six-hour investigation of the casino, and we did two seances, one with a Ouija board and one with, both with a Ouija board. And one was downstairs by the main stage, and one was upstairs in the ballroom. And we got a lot of what I call ITC, but it's people refer to it as EVP, electronic voice phenomena. But we got a lot of voices, and we did make contact with two people, one being William Wrigley and the other a man named John, who said he played with big bands in the 30s and 40s and was forced off the island because this woman that he was seeing and having an affair with forced him at gunpoint to leave and never return.
That's always a good reason to leave.
Yeah, absolutely. But there are so many places. If you go up and down from Avalon, you go to the next cove, the major cove is Toyon, which is now the Catalina Island Marine Institute for boys. It was used during World War II as, a Navy SEALs training base. And that has about 20 or 30 good ghost stories associated with that. White's Landing, which is the oldest archaeological site that we know of on the island. And then we go all the way down to Emerald
Bay.
Two Harbors.
The Natalie Wood.
Died.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In the Civil War barracks. Not many people know there's a Civil War barracks.
Let's talk about some of those, too, when we all come back. We're talking with Rob and Ann Lodarski. Ann's going to disappear now for us, but Rob will stay on. So we'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, later tonight, those Friday the 13th open lines also have been getting a lot of emails over the last few months of people, new listeners, wanting to know about those sounds of hell. So we're going to explain that a little bit sometime tonight for those of you who just don't know what that is. We'll be back in a moment. Ann is going to stay with us, with Rob as well, Lodarski, as we talk about Haunted Catalina, and we're going to get into some of their stories, more of their ghost stories in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Ann, you can't get enough of Coast to Coast. You're going to stick around for this hour, huh?
Around for another segment.
Okay, we will do that then, and we've got you here, Rob, to talk about, L.A. is, of course, noted for its film and its television stars. Are there any haunted stories, Catalina Island, about those who have passed on? You mentioned Natalie Wood a bit. What's the story there in terms of the haunting part of it?
Well, as the story goes, she and Christopher Walken and Robert Wagner, one of their favorite places was the Isthmus Cove and the Harbor Reef Restaurant and Saloon. And they would dock the Splendor there and literally go in, drink, and party till the wee hours of the morning. Mm-hmm. And pretty much everyone knows that she drowned. Ever since her body was found, and let me rephrase that. Ever since she died, people have been spotting her walking along the road between the point where she died and the isthmus, and she's wearing a red vest or jacket, and literally looking very somber, walking down the road. People will, you know, in the evening, we'll see this figure, literally just like you or myself, just walking down the road, and there 1 second, gone the next. Right. Usually along the road, people have spotted her inside the restaurant at the booth she sat at for her last meal or last drink. They will get a glimpse out of the corner of their eye. She'll be there, gone. And sighted probably in about 7 or 8 different locations, but mainly along the road leading out of the isthmus, toward the isthmus, to the Harbor Reef Restaurant. So she's a common sighting there. And, you know, given that the tragedy of the event, I think she's probably not even sure she's dead.
Isn't it amazing at these stories, not just from Catalina Island, but, you know, all over this planet, of people who are seeing these apparitions, these entities, these ghosts? They just keep coming, Robin, and don't they?
They do just keep coming, and that's a good thing for us.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is for what we do, because I guess until we figure out exactly, you know, how we penetrate that veil on a one-on-one, you know, situation where we can sit and talk to them, even though they may be in spirit, people are keeping, you know, they keep devising different means to do that. We'll be left with the occasional voice on, you know, EVP or whatever, or occasional apparition. Almost there. I think we're pretty close, but maybe the higher energy God or whatever just does not want that veil penetrated. There's some mystery to that, you know. That's
because I keep wondering, why can't we just see him all the time, you know? I mean, my mother just recently passed away, and I keep thinking, well, I should be able to see her. I mean, I do this, you know, this is what I do. Why can't I see her? I don't have the answer for that.
I don't know. It's a pretty strange thing, but it's strange how some people seem to attract spirits and other people want to see so badly, and nothing happens. Maybe, you know, it's just what Anne was saying, too. You know, maybe if we could see spirits every day, and they're probably right there next to us, we wouldn't be able to get our work done here and what we're supposed to do. So maybe there's some kind of universal law that, you know, allows us to catch a glimpse out of the corner of our eyes, or an occasional, you know, apparition, or an occasional sound bite as EVP. But maybe we're not supposed to penetrate that veil. Some things may be best left as a mystery. I don't know.
You mention in your work that the island appears to be an energy portal or door to another world. Is that where you think they're coming? I mean, they seem to be coming through this kind of a portal?
I think water plays in. And, you know, you've had so many people on the show that have talked about, you know, water and electricity and energy. And I think, you know, islands have this ability to attract or funnel energy.
It is. It's an energy field in itself, the island is. And it's a very spiritual place because, you know, let's not forget that originally it was a Native American, now, of course, a burial ground.
But, you know, major, it was part of one of the last revitalization movements. People don't remember or know about that in Southern California, and it was called Chingnishnish, and it was the worship of the raven. And literally, at the isthmus, when Juan Cabrillo came in the 1540s, they stopped there and they saw this incredible ceremony going on with this pole standing straight up, and they were dancing and doing their thing. And literally, this was the last vestige of the Gabrieleño culture and the celebration of their god on this island, and Catalina was it. This fact, and the fact that, you know, in the 60s, what we have UFOs associated with this island. It's not just about ghosts. There are other things going on. I mean, one of some of the best footage was taken, I think, in 1966 by the U.S. Navy, you know, about the UFOs. So it attracts a lot of different energy.
We have never seen those, personally.
I did.
But, oh, you did?
I did at the Ben Weston Beach. Yeah, I did.
What did that look like, Rob?
When was that?
Oh, God, back in 1973 when we were camped out.
Oh, right.
We were literally on the backside of the island. There was nobody there. In fact, this probably led up to the UFO. As we're coming back in the Jeep to our little camp spot, we see about 200 eyes, red eyes, just staring at us the archaeological site. Also, it's not that bad. As we get closer, we're going, what the heck is this? And we're moving closer, and the eyes are just staring at us. And so as we get right up to it, we're going, oh, my God, it's buffalo. What had happened was we dig our archaeological units, and the buffalo at night come and sit in them. They use them as wallowing pads. But when we saw the eyes, it was like, what do we have, like 1,000 devils sitting on this archaeological site? Well, as we're turning the corner, I looked out the side of the Jeep, and I saw this object literally, I mean, on the horizon, just this white, kind of flattish thing, just go shooting straight across the sky, stop, and go right underwater. It just dropped. I mean, it was just so unusual. I didn't say anything to anybody, and I looked around and said, anybody see that? See what? No, didn't see anything.
You two might be considered the original ghost hunters, because you've been all over the country.
By our books, we've been, since Anne was born and raised in San Antonio, and of course we did the Alamo, we've had some great experiences there. But, you know, it's a great way to meet and talk to people.
It is, yeah. People are fascinated by it. Even people that said they don't believe in it, they like to talk about it.
Yeah, they do. It's amazing.
Even though they don't believe in it, they like to talk about it.
It's like this haunted world. I mean, the most often question is that we're asked is, isn't this whole world haunted? I mean, it seems like every place we hear about has ghosts. Well, yeah.
Do you find that world events somehow correlate with the hauntings on the planet? If things are stressful or tense or we're in wars, do we tend to get more or less reports of ghosts?
More.
More, yeah, definitely. I would say more.
I think if we look at World War II and we look at some of the movies that came out, there were a lot more ghost movies or paranormal movies that come out with events like you're talking about. World War I, World War II. World War I would have been the talkies. But in World War II, we have a lot of movies coming out in the 40s. That deal with the paranormal, and just like now, I mean, look at the amount of ghost shows now.
And that's just like in the 50s when you had after the bomb, then you had all those 50s sci-fi movies about that.
Oh my gosh, the huge ants and
right,
things
them,
like
that. Yeah. That's one of our favorites.
Godzilla and all that.
Yeah, and you know, maybe it mimics, or maybe they do this to help us ease the tension that goes on. With the fact, the uncertainty, because a lot of people are dying. Let's face it, the one plane that went down in New York, these 100 people get saved, the plane goes down yesterday, and 50 people die.
Yeah, I was talking about that, too, how sad that is. Right. We, on one moment, we have incredible glee.
I know.
And then a tragedy.
But you know what? There's an interesting movie that I don't know if a lot of people saw it. It's called Millennium. And with Chris Christopherson, it was, what was it, about 10 years ago, Anne, or more than that, 20?
15 years ago.
But it's really interesting because as the plane, it's about a plane crash, and as the planes are going down, it's stopped in time and space, and these aliens or whatever take all the people off the ship. So when it crashes, they don't find any bodies. They've been extricated and taken to another place.
It's another dimension. It's about time travel.
Are they brought back? I've got to get this. I slightly remember this, but I might have to pick this up again.
It was a little bit of a howler, but, but it was very interesting because of the time travel element.
Yeah, it was a concept. So, you know, Catalina seems to have, again, for the UFOs, I mean, if we're tying this into military secrets or military operations, we've got to remember they closed down the island in the 40s. They did. They had submarine testing. They had Navy SEALs. This island was literally a U.S. training base. And a lot of the ghost stories that we have, too, conform to the 1940s, to the St. Catherine Hotel, which has since bit the dust. become part of the landscape, and we see soldiers. A blimp went down, killing seven men, and I think in the early 40s. So a lot of that, you know, it's got the history from the Native Americans to present day, to movie stars, you know, to William Wrigley, to Louis Warner. I mean, you know, Louis B. Mayer. There's so much. Clark Gable is cited there. Amelia Earhart cited there. Just an incredible place.
That is. Tell me about this former Chicago Cub baseball player that haunts the place.
That's yours, Ann.
Oh, yeah, that's the country club there. Used to be the clubhouse for the Chicago Cubs. And Dudley Moran, I don't know if he still runs Silkies. It's a little bar that he had now inside the country club. And he and all of his employees had seen numerous things. I think some of his employees actually quit and they robbed.
He couldn't
keep some people around because of the things that they were seeing.
Yeah.
They were, you know, just too afraid. And so we wanted to go in there. So he was kind enough to take us and with his two little children at the time into the place. And he had a little baby he was carrying in his arms, a darling little two-year-old blonde cherub, you know, darling child. And we went in there, and as we were walking around, the little baby was just in the sweetest little baby, smiling and laughing, you know. And we suddenly got into the kitchen area, and he just started to cry and cry. And, you know, we didn't think much of it. We just thought, well, you know, babies cry, so no big deal. But we went on, you know, moving along. Went to another part of the place, and he immediately stopped crying. And then, you know, we didn't really still think much of it. So then we walked back around. And I believe this happened three times. We went again, taking us back through around the area, because it's a large area inside. And the baby immediately starts crying again at the same spot in the kitchen. And so at this point, we're thinking, well, what is in here that we can't see
right.
that this little fella can see? So we noted that and still went on, though. I was kind of surprised he was willing to continue, you know, with the little kid there. But we went on and then finally had the whole tour and had to go back through and exit out to the same area, the kitchen. And we were all standing in line, and Rob was, I don't know if you were taking a picture or something, but you were behind us.
The door to the kitchen,
yeah. Yeah, the door to the kitchen, and the little boy was being held facing Rob. And we didn't see anything because we were looking at them. But I saw the baby just start, instead of crying, he had this terrified look on his face. And then he started just bawling. And, you know, we turned around, and Rob turned around, and it's like, what is behind me? And we didn't see anything.
But the poor little one could.
And he could, and immediately, that's when Dudley just said, I'm going to take him out of here now, you know. So we immediately left, and he immediately was fine, you know, just smiling away. And so, it was so bizarre.
You got to wonder what they see that we don't.
Oh, my gosh.
And they do.
No wonder they cry all the time.
They're seeing all kinds of stuff that we can't see. And I think, of course, our cats, too. I mean, it's the same.
Very sensitive, aren't they?
Like that, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was the clubhouse. I was there in the 1920s when Wrigley brought the Chicago Cubs over. And Dudley brought us in to tell us the story about him seeing the baseball player, who could have been Joe McCarthy, Rogers Hornsby, Charlie Grimm, anybody. But it seemed to fit Charlie Grimm more than anyone. But, you know, as he was walking out one night, he looked down the courtyard path, and he saw a baseball player coming right toward him. Baseball cap, uniform, looked like the 20s or 30s. And he just stood there and stared. And the man kept coming, and then he just vanished.
Yeah.
And I think Dudley, that was about it. He just dropped everything. I don't even think he said he bothered to close up, and he ran away.
Do you two work with other psychics and investigative teams?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we do.
We always use, if we can, use psychics in our work, because it really just adds another dimension, no pun intended, to what we do.
Yeah, there are enough dimensions as it is, huh?
Yeah, you know.
But no, it helps, I think, a lot to have that, to have a psychic.
But the interesting thing about psychics, too, is we've over the years that we've worked with, you know, probably about 30 or 40, they seem to either peel off, they leave, or they're not so accurate. I mean, a lot of the things that we do, we kind of plug in tests for them to see, you know, if they've, like, read anything about it. Or, you know, some psychics, it just seems, they seem too good to be real. You know, they're getting names. Oh, I see Jim Smith and Tom Frankenhauser and Juanita or something, and those are, you know, those are names associated with this, where, you know, 100% of the time, that's, it's just too hard. It's too hard to believe that they're going to be accurate that much. So you, you devise little tests, don't tell them about the place, and kind of over course of four or five investigations, you know, you get a sense of whether they're accurate or not, or if they're getting information. It's,
but we just have just a handful that we work with now.
Yeah, so we've winged it down.
Tell me about San Antonio, the Alamo. I mean, do we have Davy Crockett down there?
And fantastic place. You know, it was so funny. I was brought up there and never even went there until I moved away and came back. But it's so steeped in, of course, its history, but it's also extremely haunted and active.
And when we did we proposed the book to the Daughters of the Republic of Texas, DRT, who runs it.
Yeah.
You know, the man, Richard Teitz, who was running it at the time, said, oh, yeah, this would be great, and it would sell very well and everything. So we did all the research, got all the photographs, the use fees. But we had to interview the Rangers. Well, the Rangers couldn't talk to us on...
Yeah, they're very close-mouthed down there about all that.
So we had to meet them between 12 midnight and 3 in the morning, and they all came out. They would meet us out there and tell us their stories, all anonymously. And what was interesting is they were seeing the same things over and over, different men.
That's fascinating.
I mean, the coonskin caps. The one guy was telling us a story about how he walked into the Long Barracks, which is one of the only places outside the chapel, I think, that's still there. And he walked in, and they have security cameras. And as he's walking, he hears footsteps behind him, and he calls the security company, said, who's in here with me? What do you camera show? We show nothing, but we hear the footsteps. He keeps walking. They hear the footsteps. They show nothing visually. So the man's getting a little panicky, and he says, you've got to see something. I hear these loud footsteps, and absolutely nothing. He said, well, maybe you should get out. And as he turns around, he sees two Spanish soldiers or Mexican soldiers with bayonets. And they turn toward the wall, and there's the defender, and they start bayoneting him.
He sees
blood coming out the whole bit. Pulls his revolver, and by the time he gets it out, the scene dissolves. And he quits that night.
Have they heard sounds of the battle?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They've done that, too.
They have. And they've seen, people have actually from the next door Manger Hotel seen what they thought was reenactors, you know, doing their thing. And when, in fact, there were no reenactors that night.
Oh, my.
They'll see sentries. They'll hear cannons go off.
And you would think that. You would think this was staged.
Right.
Or it's some kind of, you know, maybe somebody's filming something.
Yeah, exactly. Our friend in Gettysburg, same thing. They'll be taking, you know, they'll do the reenactments, and all of a sudden when they're looking at the film, they'll see another regiment showing up that wasn't there. And they'll just see them marching into battle. And it's almost replaying history. But they'll be joining the reenactors. It's very weird how that happens.
All right, Rob, you're going to stay with us for phone calls. And Ann, I think you're going to take off now. We're going to be back in a moment with Rob Lodarski, truly a real ghost hunter. Questions and your stories next.